listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is stickier than US inflation. I'm Scott Phillips from The Motley Fool. He is Andrew Page Esquire, the founder, the managing director, the chief cook and the bottle washer of strawman.com. Mr. Page, g'day.
So many bottles to wash.
So many bottles.
It keeps me busy. But yes, hello, how are you?
I'm very, very well. And you good self?
Yeah, very good. Very good.
Nice.
No complaints.
I don't mean sticky as in not clean sticky. I mean sticky as in hanging around for a while, because we're not going anywhere. We've been doing this for a very, very long time. Longer than, I imagine. We're talking off air about some previous podcasts, and time flies when you're having fun, mate. It doesn't feel like these things happened that long ago, but we are here for a couple of hours every week. We've been doing it for a very long time. Mate, I always thoroughly enjoy your company. We're not going anywhere. We are going to stick around.
Yep.
Mate, let's start.
Don't stop us.
Let's start there, because that was the US inflation story this week. Not a lot of Australian macro news out. The big news is coming next Tuesday when the RBA released its next interest rates decision. And for those of us who are used to watching it, trying to remember when the RBA meetings are, when they're not the first Tuesday of every month now, actually is more challenging than it used to be. But next Monday and Tuesday, the RBA will meet. Next Tuesday afternoon, they will give their decision. Inflation in the US, though, mate, is seems to have hit, at least temporarily, some sort of floor, and a floor higher than most people would like. We saw core inflation, their preferred, everyone's got their preferred measure. The RBA uses a trimmed mean. The US Fed uses core inflation, which excludes the volatile stuff. In any event, that was still at 3.8%. That's not a number that they are particularly happy with. It's not coming down. It was 0.4% for the last month. Things seem stuckish. Inflation-wise, despite the Fed's best efforts, despite the RBA's best efforts, the bond market now is effectively increasing the likelihood of a hold up until, I think they want to say May was the stuff I saw in the paper yesterday. It seems like there's more to be done. I'm not sure if there's a so what, other than it's a reminder that just because you think something's going to happen doesn't mean it's going to.
Well, I think we can do a bit of a victory lap. Like, we were talking about this, well, we've been talking about this for a long time, but my thesis was always inflation is a multi-pronged kind of thing. There are a variety of factors that sort of drive it. And the headline-grabbing narrative was that there were supply chain bottlenecks. And they were. They were absolutely a huge factor. But that was always going to resolve itself, just markets doing what markets do. You know, there's a profit to be made shipping something somewhere. Someone's going to find a way. And these were always short-term things. The bigger part of it, or the underlying part of it that was sort of within all of that, was, I would argue, a lot of excess money creation. And that hasn't gone away. And in fact, this is what I find, you mentioned the bond market. This is the interesting dynamic, is that inflation, when it's around what the Fed wants it to be around, like 2%, it's not too noticeable, right? It's okay. When it becomes sticky, you have a real kind of problem as a bond investor, if you're buying long-term bonds as well. So you know what's on offer in terms of the interest rate, but you don't know what's on offer in terms of the relative purchasing power of that. You know, we know the nominal return. What's the real return going
to be? And even
what
rates may be over time too. You're betting now on a fixed income as a percentage of the purchase price from now until the end of that bond term. You may be able to resell it for a higher or lower price, but even on the income alone, you're kind of taking a bet that if I lock my money up for this amount of time, it's a worthwhile investment relative to what else might be available in a year, 2 years, 3 years' time when this bond is still not yet matured.
But bonds are an incredible investment, as interest rates had that big structural decline over many, many, many years.
Yeah, that's
it was such a tailwind.
Yeah.
The point I think that's interesting to think about is that when we say stuff like that, we think, well, okay, yeah, you've got to think about interest rates. What's the Fed going to do? And obviously that plays a part. But also remember that the market itself, the bond market itself, I would say is the more dominant factor here. You can't hold a gun to someone's head and say, buy my bond at this price.
You must buy this price, exactly, yeah.
You know, and at a point, while they have these reference rates and these interest rates that are charged to interbank loans and the things that the Fed has control over, when And this is the narrative that seems to be in the bond market as well. As inflation is sticky. The budget's in massive deficit. They're adding $1 trillion in debt every 100 days at this rate, right? We're heading into an election cycle. Yeah. You know, spending's not going to get cut. Whether it's Biden or Trump, they're both going to continue to spend like drunken sailors.
Yeah, yeah.
And bond investors are rightly sort of saying, well, I didn't really give a stuff. Well, the Fed Reserve can do what it likes. But I'm not going to lend you money for 30 years at 2%. I can tell you that right now. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And or at least that's the risk. And that's when things really, I think that's where the bigger concern for where we are at the moment is that we may just have a big period of stagflation. Mm-hmm. We need inflate. When I say need, we don't need it at all. We the people, but the government really needs a bit of inflation to get rid of the debt because it's monumental. Mm-hmm. We're in a much better shape in Australia. Yes, directionally we're heading in the same direction, but in the US, it's really at a point where it was tolerated. I think for a while it was never something that is getting the headlines that it feels like it's getting now, and it feels like it's a legitimate kind of a more legitimate concern. We can debate sort of timing of things and who knows how that plays out. But I feel as though we are, as I said before, full circle. I'll return to my original point. We're past the supply bottleneck, inflation driven kind of stuff. We are now at the more intransigent issue of all of the things that I just sort of said. And I feel as though we will probably run, when I say hot, not like Argentina levels, let's hope, kind of hot, but in terms of inflation. But getting to 2% really seems like a pipe dream at this kind of stage, particularly if they are going to roll on interest rates, which apparently is what everyone's betting as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And they kind of have to roll on interest rates because interest cost is one of the biggest line items in the government's budget. So it's a very difficult situation. And it's a long answer, but when you look back historically, generally what happens, we've talked about this before, you've got like a few major options. You can have a huge about face in terms of government spending. They just cut everything and increase taxes, but that never happens because that's just not reality. The other one is you default on all the debt, and that just doesn't happen. It's not likely to happen with the world reserve currency either. Or you enter into a period of capital controls and heightened inflation, stagflation kind of period, and you just like have a crappier time of it overall until things get back onto it. You flush out a lot of the crap in the system, you know, all the malinvestment and all that kind of stuff. And it's just a horrible and protracted period of pain for a lot of people.
Yeah. I think that's all really
pretty
thoughtful,
doom and gloomy, but
a little bit.
Steer me away from it, I guess, is what I would genuinely ask you to do for me.
It's hard to deal with very quickly. The other problem we've got is, of course, the feedback loops of inflation. You know, we've had wages are now 4.2% and in Australia, and inflation is 4.1%. Now, I'm not someone, and this is, I tweeted about this, I say regularly this podcast, I do it this during the week, because it's kind of my frame of reference, right? Because it kind of lets you see and hear at least a portion of people who respond to this stuff. And Twitter's not representative necessarily, but I talked about the fact that, you know, and this is a whole thing. So NIRU, the idea of non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. In other words, how long does employment get before inflation starts to take off? Mm-hmm. And I said basically, hey, so it turns out that if unemployment falls to 3.9% because the economy is overheating, which also drives inflation, it should be no surprise that if you try and deal with inflation by dragging down demand, you push unemployment back up because the extra jobs created were created because of that excessive demand, the excessive consumption over and above what was possible. That's that are two sides of the same
coin.
That's
the point. I mean, I made this before, which is like no one says the quiet part out loud, but we want more people to be unemployed. You just said it, right?
They don't want more people to unemployed, but they recognize that there is no alternative. They're not setting out to make people unemployed to fix inflation. They are setting out to fix inflation knowing that the side effect is more people will be unemployed.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's some semantics in that. But
no,
it's like,
I think it matters.
Hand in glove with the action.
Yes.
100%. Has the same consequence, you know.
And they're very well aware of that and they're not trying to avoid it. But it's one thing to say, they're not saying if only we could get more people unemployed, then it would fix the problem. They're saying we're going to drive down demand. We know that will fix inflation and make more people unemployed.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, I'll go with you.
All right.
It feels like double. It feels like we're saying the same thing. But I think
it's what are we trying to achieve here? Your point. They want more people to be unemployed.
Oh, I'm not saying that the goal is to make people unemployed, but I'm saying the tool is overtly to make people unemployed.
But not as the aim is my point.
No, it's not the aim, but it's the remedy. It's the means. It's the mechanism.
Yep.
Which is all good and well in an ivory tower in Martin Place, but when it's your job,
totally right.
that has to go, it's sort of like, what?
Except here's my point during the week is that's absolutely true, except we always start from a single position, which is we're already at 3.5% unemployment, therefore any more jobs lost are bad. And it is true that more jobs lost are bad because that's, as much as it's true that jobs will be lost to fixing inflation, the jobs were created because of the excess demand, which was never something that was a sensible, reasonable, sustainable thing. So the jobs created were already temporarily additional jobs because
that's important.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying.
But you're implying that those jobs were created to fulfill a demand that wasn't reasonable or sustainable.
Yes, my point.
Those jobs were created because, this is what markets do in response to demand.
Correct,
all of a sudden, beanie babies are back in fashion. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, mm-hmm. the market will absolutely respond to that.
Yep.
And even if there's an outrageous sort of demand, you can always make more beanie babies.
Yep.
The market itself will dynamically fix that. I would say when a job is lost because there's no value being created here, this is just a money-burning machine, then yes, that's kind of quote-unquote good reasons for sort of unemployment.
Yes.
But when it's sort of unemployment that's just sort of like, no, we're actually targeting industries that actually arose or grew through the growth of demand in the underlying service or product that they were provided.
Mm.
And now we've sort of, because of excess liquidity we've put elsewhere into the system that's created malinvestment and poor outcomes elsewhere.
Yeah.
The end result is what when you have these big broad brush things that are just going to hit the economy across the board, mm-hmm. you're also hurting the people that aren't necessarily part of that cohort of,
correct.
Well, your job was only there because of excess. Indirectly possibly, but
yes.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
No, it absolutely does. I'm talking aggregate level rather than the alternative. My point is when unemployment went from 4.1 to 3.5, Everyone said, see, Nauru was wrong. There is no issue. We can't have unemployment lower than 4%. See, I told you so. You stupid economists were dumb. And then when it goes back up, people say, oh, you're just trying to kill people and get people out of work. It's like, no, that's like the excess is created, the froth, the jobs created were created because of the froth. And you're right, it won't be exactly the same job lost that was created. You're absolutely right there. But the idea that Nauru doesn't exist because we just, on the way up, we wanted to believe it didn't exist. On the way down, we're annoyed because it does. It was that magical thinking at the time was we can pretend all these jobs being created are a justification for never having Nauru as high as you thought it was. But that was the point. Nauru was never, we can't possibly have unemployment below this. It was, if it goes below this, it's probably going to be because there's too much inflation. It's like, that's literally what happened. On the way back, people are like, oh, well, these jobs are getting lost. It's like, well, yes, because we've got 8% inflation at one point. This is not a surprise. This is exactly how the model says it will work.
This is where I guess you get more ideological on things, but I would say that the cure, what's the problem here? Inflation is the problem. That's what we're trying to fix. And I would say for most, but not all areas of human activity, the market itself is the cure for high prices.
Totally.
All of a sudden think about the plasma TV when it first came out. They were $10,000, right?
For a 40-inch one, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, now I can pick up three for under $500, bucks, right? It's just from Kogan or somewhere. Now, there wasn't a demand for these before they existed.
That's right.
They were invented.
Yep,
Every single house in the country's got at least one of these things now, and much, much, much better iterations of it. A whole bunch of people were employed. Did anyone this is where I fundamentally have the problem for someone, again, an academic, to say, no, there was too much demand there.
Yeah.
And that's what's caused problems. Like, no, well, there was demand there because people want what people want, right or wrong. That's what they wanted.
Totally.
And the market responded. And in responding, the market drove down the price.
Yeah.
And this is where I tend to think that what we just get the hell out. This is why I'm so anti-central bank. and I know that's a harsh statement, but it's just like, as a lender of last resort to back up the banking system is one thing. When it's more directly involved in trying to set a command market for the cost of money, for the cost of money, like the most fundamental communication mechanism we have in our modern economy, it creates these unintended consequences. We have a problem. We respond to fix it. How? By printing up a ton of money, throwing that into the system. It causes inflation. We muddle from one problem to the next. When it's just like, get the heck out of the way, right? Like I don't know. I know we fundamentally disagree.
We
at this
do,
point,
and that's okay.
I just like, you know, some academics sort of saying, no, there's a perfect unemployment rate, and if it was below this, then this happens with inflation, and above that, I think it's too simplistic. I know the maths is, you know, they like the econocrats like the maths and the models that go along with all of those things. I just don't think it passes muster for me anyway. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think there's two ways to look at it. I think you can. There's two types of economists, right? There are the predictors. And there are the explainers. And I think economics is always best when it's explaining rather than predicting.
Yeah.
And so for my, and I, again, I on Twitter, people say, well, what do you, so you, you know, the number was this and it's not that anymore. I'm like, why do you think it should be that number? I'm like, no, I never said it should be that number. What I said was the mechanism exists. You know, I'm no trained, I've done economics at uni, but you know, I don't class myself as a capital E economist. But the relatively simple reality is the explainer is when there's excess demand, and I don't mean excess might be the wrong word, mate, given your framework. But when there's a significant bump in demand that causes a bump in prices, that will create a bump in employment and a reduction in unemployment for the reasons you would expect. And then, like every boom and bust, when the boom goes away, when the demand goes away, whether it's manufactured removal or just market-based removal, whether you know it's central banking or just the economy doing what the economy does in your preferred model, that reality is demand falls, and some of the jobs that were needed when there was higher demand no longer needed in a situation of lower demand. That's you know whether inflation gets fixed naturally or econocratically. That's a new word for us. That happens, right? The simple reality is that we got excess employment effectively for a short period of time because demand was through the roof for a period of time. When that demand goes away, what do you expect? Businesses fail, people lose jobs. That's part of the cycle. And those who wanted ideologically to say that you know that we can have we've got 3.5%, therefore it's possible, therefore there's no negative consequences, therefore we should assume that can always be doable. Oops, what do you mean unemployment's going back up now? You know, and it was just this really magical thinking of I can pretend Nauru, not as an individual number, not as a target, I have no number in my head of like it must be 4.1 or 4.5 or 3.9, but just the idea that you know somehow these gains in employment can magically be sustained when demand falls through whatever purpose, through whatever mechanism, you know the fact that economies are cyclical. I find it so incredible. And so anyway, on Twitter, people are saying, oh, you're saying that wages are causing, this is where we started, by the way. You're saying wages are causing inflation. No, I'm not. I didn't say that at all. What I said was employment was linked to inflation. Oh yeah, but you said, no, I didn't. And people have this instinctive view. That being said, mate, well, the point I was going to make, actually really, really fun tangent, but the point I was going to make was we are now, I don't think we have a wage price spiral, but I do think, I think the Reserve may have said this. I can't remember who said it. Was a Treasury data actually a couple of weeks ago. Wages are now a really significant portion of the inflationary problem because a lot of that short-term supply chain problem, you know, the money printing has gone away, not in terms of the dollar value of it, but the year-on-year growth of that, the impact it adds to demand is gone.
Yep.
Year-on-year, what's driving prices? People are going to hate me saying this, but wages are a significant part of that. They just must be by definition because wages are now higher than inflation and wages are a decent portion of costs. I know ideologically people don't want to hear it. I'm sorry about that. It wasn't the cause of it, but it's part of the reason it's been sustained.
Well,
which
that's what I was going to say. I think this is why it's such a diabolically difficult area of study because you've got a gazillion data points of anything you want to measure, and we've got statisticians that measure everything. And again, I start with the base axioms for me when looking at an economy is the recognition of it as a dynamic, chaotic kind of system.
Yeah.
Right? It just is. And when you look at all, you will find humans are pattern seeking animals, right? And you will see all and this is always the conundrum in science, correlation versus causation.
Oh yeah.
Do you know? And so if I want to say I've got a theory of the economy and I think things work like this, I guarantee you I will pull some data together that supports that kind of view, which is why we can, you know, after hundreds of years of doing this, we can still have a lot of sort of debates about this kind of stuff. So that is all true. I with the wage price inflation stuff, the spiral stuff, I think where people get tripped up there is that they you're going to make a your frame of reference for a comparison matters a lot, is what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
So I'm going to look at the current figure now for inflation growth over the last three months and then wages growth. And you go, whoa, wages are growing well above it. And you go, hang on, prices jumped 20% in the last 4 or 5 years and now wages are coming up. It's still nowhere, it's no, on a real adjustment basis, on average, because there's always exceptions, but on average, people's purchasing power has gone down. And so it gets a lot. And so now people go, oh, so we, you know, wages are causing it. Now you do, I do actually do think you do get to that sort of part where, well, wages go up and therefore we need to increase prices here. And then, you know, someone's wages is someone's costs who's running a business. Right. You know, it sort of, it can feed on itself. It can absolutely feed on itself. But it's sort of what kicks it off in the first place.
Correct.
And my point is, and I'm not making it well, but my point is that in terms of the chicken and the egg, the thing that came first here is the inflation.
Yes, 100%.
And then the wage. Now the wages, now that the plates are spinning, maybe that can have a momentum to that. Mm-hmm. But the inflation came first, is all I'm saying. Because of excess money creation. Again, money is just a means to keep track of things in the economy. It's all it is. It's just a language. And we have so much stuff in the world. We get better at making that stuff and providing those services every year.
Yep.
But when you look at what we do en masse, like the number of widgets and services and haircuts and lawns that we mow all up, grew at a slower pace than the unit of account that we measure everything with. And it's like, well, do the maths. Like there's only the thing to adjust in that.
More money chasing less stuff or the same amount of stuff. There is no, it's maths.
We get it as investors when we talk about profit and earnings per share. Like no one bats an eyelid. But when you talk about money and the economy, it's like, well, it's the same. It's the exact same thing.
Correct.
And I think that is the problem. Now, again, there's different schools of thought here. And it's like, well, sometimes that's good if you employ that newly created money and you direct it well and, you know, you take excess out when you can afford. So let's not get into that debate. but whatever you think it's a tool for good or evil, it is a factor. Yeah. It is a big factor. In fact, the dominant factor in my humble view.
100%. And I do want to, though, continue back the wages bit, mate, because the problem with inflation is it's year on year. So we don't measure inflation over 5 year or 10 year periods. Maybe we should, but
you just add it all up. Yeah.
But the reality
I've done it before. I put it on a chart. I don't tweet often, but you'll see it if you go to my profile. It's just not that far long ago, and it's just the cost of things has gone up. On one chart goes one line goes through the roof, and the other is flat. Right.
Yes. The challenge is that as of when we measure annual inflation, it's the things that have changed since this time last year.
Yes.
And this is why the wage piece as a contributor to prices going up right now is so important. It's back to the point about the US Fed. It's why is it sticky? Because we've kind of, the first order impacts have come and gone. The second and third order impacts, when my wage went up this year because last year I had to pay more for petrol or wheat or something else, my wage is now part of the problem. And then next time when there's another enterprise bargaining or individual contract or minimum wage case decided, someone's going to say, well, inflation's high this year. Now, inflation's high this year and you can choose your ideology, choose your preferred villain. It's corporate profiteering, it's prices, it's wages, it's everything else. The simple reality is that year on year, wages, I don't know what wages are as a percentage of the economy. I imagine they're going to be more than half in terms of cost. Maybe they're
huge,
not.
Huge, whatever it is.
Right, massive. So let's say it's, I don't know, 50% of the, I don't know, pick a number, it's probably not. But if wages are in excess of inflation and they make up half the inflation rate or half the GDP, half the impact on costs and prices, that is going to be a factor. Now, you know, you have your ideology. I don't really care what people think about, you know, what I do care, but, you know, everyone's got their own ideology that they bring to the table. The simple reality is this is the second, third order impact, which is exactly, as I said a million times, whether you think it should be an RBA or not, the RBA has warned for years we don't want inflation, the globally imported inflation, to become endemic in the domestic economy. That's precisely what we, and frankly, the Yanks are dealing with right now, is the things that went up because of last year's inflation are now this year's inflation. And that's the only thing that matters. Whether and how we make people whole on purchasing power is a very, very good question. I don't have the answer to that because it must, by definition, add to inflation for an extended period of time. And this is the very definition of the wage price spiral. And it's exactly why it's so bloody hard. And it's why, again, I don't actually know what I don't know how, maybe I'm mindful to kick off a tangent. I will anyway for fun. This is one of the reasons why I think, you know, if central banking was at all useful to cap the growth in inflation during that period of time, I don't know how much worse it would have been, how you would make it better, and how you would avoid that kind of spiraling other than waiting for things to blow up and then starting again with the debris. But in any case, that's why, you know, that inflation you talk about, it was so important that it didn't happen in the first place, rather than getting to the point of how do you fix it? Because you can't make people whole in any responsible way without prolonging the pain. You know, how long do you have high inflation for if you try desperately to just incrementally get people's purchasing power back for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, which must put wages up by definition, which must push inflation up? You'd spend a decade and a half getting out of this if you try to do it, I imagine, in any methodical way, surely.
Yeah. I mean, you can't, you have to let it naturally, my viewpoint would be you have to let it naturally evolve out of the system. Let the market determine where the capital needs to be employed. When I say that, it sounds very cold and calculating. It's not. It's just saying, let people buy what people want to buy. You want to go buy a jet ski? Fill your boots. You know, you want to save it all under the mattress in gold? Knock yourself out. I don't care. And that's, you know, do what you like, right? But whatever demand arises from the populace, there'll be someone who'll satisfy that kind of stuff. And then if someone is making a lot of profit, others will notice that and they'll come in and they'll compete and they'll drive prices down and drive services and quality high. I mean, that's how a properly functioning market should sort of operate. So I feel as though we get too concerned with stability of prices, not recognizing that price changes are radically important. They signals everything. Anyone who's run a business, anyone who's just running their own personal budget, right? Like everything I do as an economic agent is conducted through and measured by money.
Yep.
We've just got a ton more shekels out there, right? And we have to wait. So we have to wait for the economy and our productive capacity to catch up to where that was. Correct. For those shekels to ever have the same purchasing power again.
That'll take such a long period of time.
Well, and it's the adjustment is brutally unfair too, because let's think about this. We're talking about all these inflation problems. What's the NASDAQ doing? What's Bitcoin doing?
Yeah, that's right.
What's housing doing? Like what anyone, and again, it's not a generational, I don't want to make it a generational thing, but there is a certain cohort that on average, I shouldn't make it an age thing. When I say cohort, I mean, there's a sizable proportion of people in society, probably close to 25% plus, who have never had it better.
Yeah.
And what's the difference between them and the fiery working overtime trying to make ends meet? It's like, well, they owned a bunch of assets.
Yep.
And when, again, you want is there value in a nice 3-bedroom brick home? Yeah, absolutely there is. Will the market supply that, respond to meet that that very high demand? Yeah, but very slowly. In other words, when measuring that asset against the asset of the Australian dollar or US dollar, whatever measurement you want to use, it's going to go up. It's going to go up. And so this is what's so difficult about it, because in anyone in that situation is like, I will happily take 7-8% inflation per year if my net asset value is growing at 12%. Now, does it screw over a whole bottom half of society? Yeah, it does. But that's the reality of it.
Yep.
So, and that's why I think it's so brutally unfair and difficult with all of these kinds of my broader point being, we should really move on after this, but is that this, what we are living through now and have been for the last few years, has been a consequence of the response to COVID. In other words, let's not get into that, but that's what it was, right? If COVID didn't happen, I reckon our inflation problems wouldn't be anywhere near where they
absolutely
are now.
And I won't get too far into it, but I would argue the response to the response was the issue.
Yes.
Regardless of how much you think should or shouldn't have been done during COVID, I'm someone who I've been very critical of Scott Morrison on more than one thing over the past. I think I've said before, responses to economic shock should be big, fast, and ugly, which is exactly what they did. JobKeeper, JobSeeker, like just throw a truckload of money out there now just so we can keep this thing from imploding and then work out what to do next. The problem was they then didn't do the, so what should we do next? They went, hey, let's keep going with this stuff.
Good enough. Let's keep going.
And then when they finished, like, right, we're done. So, but you just did all this stuff. You know, it's like letting the kid throw the toys around the room and saying, all right, well, you had fun throwing the toys around the room. I kind of got to clean it up now. And it was never cleaned up. And they just literally walked out of the room and said, well,
it's exactly the problem. And again, it's, without getting into that, but the end result, right or wrong, was a bunch of extra money in the system.
Correct.
I mean, even people who, again, look, should have we helped people? Well, yeah, don't get me wrong. Absolutely. Yeah. But someone who wasn't hurting at all of a sudden, I get to work from home and now the state government's paying for my kids' shoes on top of all of this, and I can tap this and I can do this. And it's just sort of like, this is fantastic.
Which again,
I know a lot of people in that scenario who's like, for them, it's sort of like, especially the introverts I know in my life. Like, that was the not only socially but financially. Like COVID was a godsend, and for others it destroyed lives. Yeah, you know, and it's sort of anyway. Let's not get into that. But my point being is, we in 2024 are having these issues because of what happened then, and why that matters is because we can't go back in time. But what we do now.
Correct.
Right? Is going to like percolate 12, 18, 24 months down the track. 100%.
And what we should have been doing 2 years ago is what we're paying for now.
Yep. And what problems we will or won't have in 2026 will be a consequence of what we do or don't do now.
Correct.
And, you know, the stakes are high. The stakes are high because it impacts all of us in one way or another and in a brutally unfair way.
That was a spectacularly large arc, but we made it back. Let's move on, mate. I haven't watched about this one, but I'm sure you've seen it in the papers. We had a couple of interesting comments made this week by a couple of heavy hitters. The chair and CEO of JP Morgan Chase, one of the biggest investment and retail banks in the world, Jamie Dimon, has said he thinks there is a 65% chance of a global recession this year. 65 is a lot. One in three, that's the usual. You throw that out with the fish chip wrapper stuff.
Hedge your bets. Yeah,
that is that's not only just likely, but two thirds chance, right? Twice as likely as not, effectively, of a recession, which I thought was huge. Phil Lowe, less controversially, and probably just kind of towing the line a little bit at the central bank, but was effectively saying, just remember, rates could still go either way. And, he said, he basically said, look.
And everyone went, wait a second, fool me once. We've heard your forecast before, pal.
Well, he was saying they could go either way. That was the point was, and he was, to be fair, again, this was mainly just kind of, looking after his successor. Because he basically said, look, just remember when Michelle Bullock said it could go either way, it could go either way, guys.
So
I was more repeating that. That was less stark, although interesting because it was his first kind of foray into public commentary since leaving the job last year. Or when I say leaving, being booted by Treasurer Chalmers. Jamie Dimon's call though, big one, mate. You and I are famously, dismissive of people making forecasts because it's the old thing of, get you a headline or whatever. That being said, Jamie Dimon, I don't know how much he's worth, but he's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The bloke doesn't need the book sales, right? He doesn't need his name in lights. He's perfectly fine. He's not doing this to try and, sell another book. What do you make of all that, mate? Do you have a sense?
Is this the guy that was like, right in the thick of it during the GFC and his company? Is this the company that's been fined hundreds of millions of dollars for laundering money for cartels? JP Morgan, I'm going to say it because most won't, but I don't think they're exactly an institution that cover themselves in glory. He's made some woefully bad calls in the past. All that being said, I'm probably with him. I kind of think it's more likely than not. I don't know if I'd go 65%, but I'd say it's more than a coin toss. We'll see. We'll see.
What's funny about recessions, mate, is I tweeted about this during the week. If you have an economy that grows at 5% in year one and declines at 0.1% for two straight quarters, you got a recession, right? So the economy's grown at 4.8% over 2 years, but it's in recession. Another economy that grows at 0.1% for two straight years is not in recession. And I don't want
to- It's a dumb, I want to get away from, I hate that definition. I hate it. The more I've pondered it, the more I hate it.
But by the way-
It's what everyone does though. It's what everyone does.
Correct. And because everything is human biology. We need labels because the heuristic of, unless I can label it, I know what it is. Once I know what it is, then I can deal with it rather than just living in the gray of, let's try and make things better. Whether they're great or terrible, let's try and make things a bit better. Let's try and set ourselves up for long-term success. We kind of go, well, what is it? Where are we? And what's happened? And what's coming next? And the R word gets thrown around because it helps us categorize things. And it's completely normal, completely natural. We're just not evolutionary. I was talking about it. My wife's in education. We're talking about this the other day. We're just not evolutionarily set up to be investors or to deal with the financial world. Our society has advanced faster than humans have evolved. Mm-hmm. We are literally falling further and further behind. And you wonder why these things happen. This is how it happens. So I raise that for 2 points. One is that everyone would still rather slow and steady rather than whipsaw, right? Because whipsaw mm-hmm. costs jobs, and we've just talked mm-hmm. a whole lot about that, so we won't redo that ground. But it's also true that, again, it's a bit like inflation. You know, year on year, if inflation falls to 2%, success, victory. And to your point, your graph, well, hang on, we're still 10 or 15% behind. Yeah, but there's no inflation anymore. It's like, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's both at the same time.
Yeah, it's a valid point.
Right, but it's both at the same time. You know, 0.1% a year for 2 years is anemic and terrible and not enough. And you know, the population is probably going faster. And I'm not suggesting one is perfect, the other is terrible, or one is worth thinking about, the other is we should ignore. I would rather have, you know, 2 years of 2.5 than 1 year of 5 and 1 year of -1, or, you know, 2 years of plus 0.1. But it's just worth remembering that if we do go into a recession after a really, really great year, there will be dislocation because of exactly what we talked about. The excess demand being shed is going to cost businesses and jobs. It just will. And we would have been better off had it not happened. Whether we should stop it or not comes down to, again, that view about central banks and governments. But independent of that, it's just worth saying, if we do end up with a recession, is it a terrible thing? Well, if the economy goes backwards, it's going to cost jobs and businesses. So yeah, that's bad. But overall, are we still in a better place net than if we'd not had that boom in the first place? Again, very, very open question. Now, I say that all a little bit hypothetically because I'm not sure the boom we've had, and we've just talked about exactly that. So again, we're kind of covering similar-ish ground. The boom we had is largely driven by a whole lot of shortages of money printing. You know, it's not exactly a typical, economic growth boom. It was engineered is the wrong word because it wasn't deliberately caused, but it's an artificially created one for those reasons. Yeah. So it's an interesting one. Will we have a recession? I don't know. I don't really have a good grasp on the world demand and what would have to happen. China's still growing at 5%. Maybe that becomes 4. They're going to be a net contributor as the second largest economy in the world. The Eurozone has been an absolute mess since the GFC. The Yanks have been stronger than most people expected. Maybe that comes off, and maybe that's where the recession happens. But there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of bits and pieces that could potentially change the way we think about some of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The reason I hate the definition is because it misses all of that subtlety that you just outlined. Yeah. And I think this is okay to say on the pod, but there's people will be familiar with it. Cut this out otherwise.
Yeah, that's right. Children, cover your ears.
Everyone's leaned into the speaker. Do you remember there was one of the Supreme Court justices in the US?
Yeah. Can we say adult entertainment? Can we use that phrase?
Say what?
Can we use adult entertainment as the phrase you're about?
Yes, you know where I'm going.
So let's do that. You're going.
When asked to define, you know, what adult entertainment was, he said, well, I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
And I think it's been quoted a lot, and it's a very good quote because I think it's the same.
It's hard to define, but you know it when you see it. Yeah, exactly.
You know it when you see it, right? Yeah. You know, it's some things are just self-evident is probably the best way to sort of say it. And it's, if you want to like formally define, if you're trying to train an AI on, well, this is and this isn't,
yeah,
and here's
that's
the
right.
exact line.
That's right.
You cross this line and it goes from not adult entertainment to adult, you know.
Yes.
It's the same with recessions. Is my point. I think we navigated that that pretty well.
Kids are curious, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I know we've got school kids that listen, so I've got to be careful. I would say that we're actually, for a lot of people, they are in recession.
That's right.
I actually don't want to be too pedantic with this stuff, but again, talking about inflation, mm-hmm. inflation's an entirely personal thing. You and I have a different basket of goods. You know, we're not the same person.
Correct.
So our inflation is definitionally
Andrew has a lot different. More caviar than I have, just for the record.
Just exactly. You're not feeling the caviar pain like I'm feeling right now. is all I'm saying. And so when you sort of say, well, what defines a recession? Well, it's a general economic hardship that's suffered. I've made the point many, many, many times on the pod is that I think we have a real bifurcation or an increasing wealth gap in society.
Yep.
And again, we talk about the economy and is it in recession and is it this two consecutive quarters of that? But again, as I made the point before, I don't even think it's a controversial fact. I think, again, it's self-evident. Some people, loaded up on assets with a high paying job, but never had it better regardless. And there are others, like I read the other day that the number of people sleeping rough is at all time record highs.
Right?
I'm going to forget the percentage level, but it is spiked massively. Food bank demand is through the roof. And again, it's not, if it's not in your suburb, it's not in your suburb. It's invisible, but it's happening, right? And so I often think that, you know, you and I are just opining in our armchairs here. There'll be some people out there going, what are these guys talking about? This is great. Others like, you have no idea how, you are so out of touch. And they're both right. They're both right because it is a personal thing. And so to bring it back to something more practical, I think recession is something when you would see unemployment go well above what a reasonable person might consider full employment. You know, anyone who really wanted a job could get a job if they wanted one. If we go with that kind of definition.
If you think about it, there's a normal cycle that oscillates around a certain number. When it gets meaningfully outside that normal range,
yes,
then you're right, yeah. Yep.
When you get to a situation where no matter how aspiring and hardworking and motivated you are, your back's against the wall. Yeah. That's a different scenario. And I don't know what threshold, you know, what percentage of the population needs to be there before we go, okay, it's a recession. Yep. But just back to sort of, you know, Jamie Dimon's comments, you know, it's like, well, I think he's right but I don't know if you've been tracking what's happening in San Francisco, but you don't want to walk out on the streets there at night. Like, this is one of the top tier US cities and just the tent cities that have popped up. I feel as though when I cast my gaze around it, sort of like, well, I don't know, if you want to call it a recession or not call it a recession, but things are not moving in a good direction, I would say, at a society level. Put yourself out of the equation for a second. I just don't feel as though, I'm not saying they're awful or, you know, and things are clearly a lot better than they were in the distant past, but I think directionally, things are headed in that direction. And what's difficult about it is it's not something that, oh, well, this is happening because of this that will soon resolve itself. It seems structural at this point and very, tenacious. I don't know. Is that too doom and gloom? I'm being very doom and gloom as usual.
You are getting a bit doom and gloom. I would just throw the definition of recession out. It's like bear markets and corrections.
Yes,
and all that
kind of thing. Perfect, stupid. Perfect comparison.
It's just stupid, right? And I don't mean stupid as in, I don't blame people for wanting to know. Because the thing about recession is you can go in, then you can come out. So there is also some psychic benefit coming out of recession. The sense of we're now in clear water, right? You're sailing under the storm clouds and then it's storming and you kind of know there's a storm and you exit the storm and you kind of feel better about it. And you think, well, there's blue sky, that's great. Those things are kind of, they are kind of, for many, many people who, I'm no better than anybody else other than you and I have been spending a lot of time thinking about human behavior and psychology and investing, right? But people, until they have had the opportunity to learn differently and approach things differently, need those markers. They need those signposts. Mm. Everyone wants to know, you know, the old, if you're going through hell keep going type stuff. That's kind of, people need that, the light at the end of the tunnel. And so I don't blame anyone for thinking that way about it. It's not very useful. I would stop using it altogether, but I get why people want it. And we frankly conditioned people because we reported about it for 20 or 30 years, like GDP. 40 years ago, no one could have told you what GDP was. Yeah. But we've financialized the whole economy, not just housing, to the point where GDP kind of is front page news where it used to be page 48 in the business section.
Yeah. And one metric out of a million that we could use to measure things. And
exactly. And you know, it's the old line about not everything that can be counted counts, not everything that counts can be counted. So exactly. So that's important. I would get rid of the definition of recession. It's stupid. Second thing I think, mate, is, and we've kind of already done the GDP thing, is the changes there are fascinating because does GDP even matter? You know, in the context of it's a total number, who shares? Even per capita GDP, which is, you mentioned recession. We've been in recession for a year. At a personal level, at a household level, at a per person level, we have been going backwards as an economy because of the population has been growing faster than the economy.
Yep.
Now that is unquestionably bad. That being said, even within that, the average person doesn't get the average share of GDP. And so even if it was true, the number of people, the degree to which people are going backwards matters as much, if not more, than the average numbers and the total numbers for the economy. Now, it's also fair to say if the economy is growing at 5%, there's a much, much, much better chance everyone's doing a bit better because rising tide does lift all boats. So at the extremes, it does matter. It is useful and it's indicative and it's positive. And generally speaking, with exceptions, it's good. There are environmental damage that gets done that doesn't get counted. And, you know, it doesn't count human happiness and overtime and overwork and family relationships and stuff. So it's dramatically imperfect. But to the extent that we want to talk about economic well-being, larger numbers in either direction tell us more instinctively and instructively, what's the average person is likely going through. When it's a modest number, roughly somewhere around zero, to your point about the inflation basket, same with the GDP basket, GDP goes up, but I don't get a pay rise. Doesn't matter to me. I get a pay rise, GDP goes down. It still doesn't matter to me. But it does tell the, you know, at a national level, those things are important because at the end of the day, how else do you, you know, the average person's numbers are the average person's numbers. You have to have some way of benchmarking as part of a suite of data points, to your point.
That's the key.
What you would use.
Yeah. So I agree. We talk about this a lot when we talk about analyzing a company.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, don't just look at the PE or the yield and go, I'm buying, the PE is 4. Like, whoa, there is 1,000 things that you can look at and probably should look at before you make an informed decision.
Or even the market. The market is on a PE of 15. So do you buy nothing? No, well, there's some out there that's less than 15, some that's smaller than 15.
It's
you don't buy or not buy individual companies based on the market average PE.
And yet it's just as silly to go, GDP is this, unemployment is this, and therefore everything good or bad. Like, what? No. Well, maybe, but maybe not. Like, you can't infer it from just those two data points. So it's so many things, you want that holistic view. And again, it's not to be negative for the sake of being negative, but I think it feels to me, and I don't have any hard data I haven't put a presentation or a TED talk together, you know, with some lovely slides and animations and the rest of it.
Yeah.
But it does feel as though directionally, two things are true at the same time, where some people are getting much better off and others doing it as hard as they ever have. And I think proportionally it feels as though the people in the second camp are growing.
Yeah. It's interesting too, and that this is relativity matters, right? Both in terms of perceived well-being. You know, everyone in Australia is phenomenally better off than people in some parts of Asia and Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Does that matter? On one level, yeah, absolutely, because they're probably in better health, probably at longer life expectancy. On the other hand, as a society, we, you know, to your point about money, everything's measured that way, right? You know, we could all buy a loaf of bread priced in insert country currency here in Africa or Asia. But if we can't all buy the loaf of bread in Australia because the price is what it is because of the society we live in, that's what matters far more than, you know, what you, a transaction you'd never otherwise make. And that's important.
Yeah.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Mate, do I have permission to rant?
Please. You have the floor, sir.
God love politicians, mate. This week we have heard that the LNP opposition, if they are elected, are planning to let people take $50,000 of their superannuation and use it to buy a house.
Called it. I called it.
Now, you did. I am thankfully, the government thus far is refusing to play along with that, and it may come to an election and people have to decide how they want to vote at that point.
People, when asked to vote about would you like access to this pot of money that you can't touch presently, a lot of people are going to go, yeah. And frankly, you can understand why. But go on.
And here's why. But yes, and here's why I'm ranting about it. I want to make sure every one of our listeners knows how completely stupid this idea is, right? Not because I have an ideological preference for or against the party proposing it, not because I have even a ideological view about housing in and of itself. Here's the thing that happens. If you take $50,000 of your super and put it towards housing, and if I do the same and everyone else does the same, we've talked for the last 40 minutes about supply and demand. And what happens when you have more demand chasing the very same supply? This thing that's supposed to help.
First home owners grant kind of thing.
Over and over again.
It didn't work the first 20 times, but I've got a good feeling about this time.
They are going to throw more money. You said this last week, mate. It's been in my ears all week. It's like trying to put out a fire by pouring more petrol on it.
Yeah.
And I never ever heard, I've probably been in a cave somewhere. I never heard of it. It's just such a perfect way to describe it, right? They've said, okay, housing isn't affordable enough. What we should do is give people, everyone, or all first homeowners anyway, more money to bid against each other to make housing more affordable.
It's worse. It's worse.
Hang on.
Who's getting the money? When you say give them more money, no. The vendor's getting the money.
Oh, right? I'll get to the super bit in a minute.
Yeah. Please go on. I'll make that point because that when you follow the money, right? Like, what is the end result of that? Prices get bid up. Who benefits from the higher prices? The sellers. Not the buyers, a disadvantage. I mean, for the buyers, it's a wash because everyone, except now I've got 50 grand less in my super.
Yeah, right. So here's the thing. Everyone uses the 50 grand. It doesn't make housing any more affordable. This is why this is such a cynical political attempt. I don't believe the people proposing this, and I don't care about their party affiliation. I don't believe they're stupid enough to believe this is actually helping affordability, right? Because
there's a chance.
No, there's not. Blind Freddy can tell you Year 8 economics can my 11-year-old can tell you, if you throw more money at the same amount of things, the price goes up, right?
We were just talking about that before with inflation. Right?
That's my point. Yes. That is literally 101. So if you say, I'm going to make housing more affordable by getting people to use their super to throw at it, it's clearly not the case. Here's the worst part, mate, if there is a worst part. Actually, there's a couple, but here's the next one. Once you open that floodgate, every other poor bastard has to do the same thing, because what you've just done is push the price of housing up. And so people who didn't want to use their super now have no choice but to use their super because everybody else is using their super. So once you push up that price by using superannuation, once two people do it, then a third's got to do it if they want to compete, because they couldn't afford to buy before. Now the price has gone up. You can only afford to buy by using your super because everyone else has got 50 grand to spend. You can't do it with nothing. So what do? You have literally no choice but to use your super. They have locked in a requirement for every single first home buyer to use their, to effectively empty their superannuation to buy a house. It is absolutely disgraceful. Now, here's
the worst part. The worst part of it is they're talking about this now after I've bought a house.
You're not a first home buyer.
I just, if it came through and I could get that through the door before that bigger effect came into play, that
that's first mover advantage. Yeah,
your first mover advantage.
So here's the other thing, right? So they're going to say, allegedly,
which by the way is part of the game theory, right? That's what drives it. That's why he's kind of like, you're playing this game. I want to be there first, like it or not, because someone's going to do it. Yeah.
So then there's the super bit. Now we saw during COVID, 750,000 people emptied their super. Literally scraped the bottom of the barrel, went back to zero so they could, in a very few cases, pay the mortgage, and in the rest of the cases, buy a jet ski or a television or whatever else they wanted to waste their money on. 750,000 Australians, which is going to cost the Fed, this is the last one, this isn't this one, which is going to cost the federal budget $85 billion in total in future because of the increased pension requirements for that group of people.
Can I quickly interject? I want to underscore the size of that number, because your go-to there is, well, there's what, 25 million people in Australia, so actually that's a big percentage, but I posit that it's much bigger, because take away kids, take away people who are already retired without super, you know, there's...
Unless you took the money out and didn't empty it.
Yes. So that's 750,000 people out of the people who have a super balance, you know, which maybe that's only like 15 million or something.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and that's 20 grand during COVID. This time around, it's $50,000. Now, the opposition say, what's going to happen? You're going to use it for housing, but if you sell the house, you've got to put it back in super. Now, let's assume for the fun of it, that's actually what happens. Let's just assume that's true. The chances that over the next 40 years, housing goes up at anything like the rate of the average super fund is incredibly small. Not impossible, because I can't say that's impossible. What I will say is, we've talked about house prices before, and I don't want to get back into that necessarily. Suffice it to say, listen to our episodes, and I am absolutely of the view that it can't go up as fast as housing. Not only that, if you do, who's going to sell that house, have 50 grand less to put in, to buy the next house? So the whole thing is just completely, completely, completely screwy. Here's the thing, mate. I want people to use their fingers for a second. Let's say it's 50 grand. Let's say 50 grand was left in super to compound. Let's say you could get 9% a year, which is the average growth of the Australian share market. I'm going to make those numbers, Mike, because it's easy for me. 27, let's say you're 27 year old, it's like 50 grand out. By the time you're 67, that's 40 years. Now, very simple math says, the rule of 72 is, if you want to find out how long it takes something to double, you divide the return, as I said, 9% into 72, and you get eight years. So in 40 years, your money could double five times. Do it with me at home, people. The first double is 100 grand, then 200, then 400, then 800, then $1.6 million between 27 and 67 if you earned the historical share market average rate. Now, you'll have other super by 67. So you wouldn't have touched this particular pot of money until much later. So keep going. Let's say another 8 years till you needed that money. $3.2 million. Let's say another 8 years after that. $6.4 million based on the fact that some politician wants you to spend 50 grand of your super in your 20s to buy a house because they reckon it's going to improve affordability.
Yeah, and they don't actually give you the choice. It's not a choice. It's right, a false
once
choice.
It starts. Correct.
Because once it starts, I've got no. If I want, look, do you want a house or not? Well, yeah,
I've got 50
I do.
Grand. You haven't got. I'm going to bid against you, Andrew. Can you do it?
It's
that
a
50
fundamental
grand?
Desire, and will always. He's never ever going away, no matter what happens in the future. And it's just sort of like, well, that's your choice. Continue to live in a tent, or drain your super. So now, you don't have a choice.
Let me finish this one. The line from the politicians, which is incredibly seductive, is, but surely having a home is better than having superannuation. And I say, yes, it absolutely is. Except that Australia is one of the top half dozen wealthiest nations in the world. If we are telling our young people, I've got a home, I've got super. Andrew's got a home, he's got super. If you're telling our young people that they have to, in Australia, in 2024, choose between a house and super, and you don't think there's something fundamentally broken about housing affordability, if that is the only choice you can make to have a home, then the whole thing is completely, completely screwed up. And I would use a stronger word if it was after hours, but it's not.
Yep.
It is an absolute mess. You should not, and everyone on Twitter says to me, largely people who are either in favor of the policy on ideological or political grounds, well, at least they got a home. It's better than having super. Yeah, it is better than having, home is better than super, absolutely. You know what's better? Both. And when we say, particularly older people like us, frankly, people older than us, other people our age, say, sorry, kids, we got both. You have to choose. Mm. That is a fundamental betrayal of the younger generation.
How do you look at it any other way? There are some things that get debated, and I just kind of think, if this was a debate, like in a debating contest, and I was put on the other side, and you have to argue, I was like, where do I start? Like, beyond just throwing out some tropes, like, I don't know. I'm 100% with you. It is madness. I called it, and I'll call it again. Whether this particular, the specifics of this idea get up or not, I would say over the coming decades, it is the biggest of honeypots that's out there. Our pension superannuation system is the envy of a lot of the world, and it's worth how many trillions. It just, when push comes to shove, governments will do this because it's there. Yep. Because when stuff's getting real and you look around and go, we need to fix this problem. Gosh, we're already in massive deficit. Our debt's already climbing. It will happen in one way, shape, or form. And so what we've done is we had this incredible scheme that was designed to take all this pressure off the public purse and ensure that we all had a higher quality of living in our retirement. Mm-hmm. And then we turned it into a tax haven for the wealthy. And now we're just turning it into a honeypot for housing speculation. And it's such a tragedy. It's such a tragedy.
With the exception that you say we are turning into, we have the choice not to turn into a honeypot if we choose otherwise.
We will.
No, I'm not going to. I'm not prepared to accept that.
I think when it comes down to it, and it's not. It's going to sound like I'm saying, oh, all people are dumb, so of course it will. It's not. But having recently gone through this and knowing a lot of people that do, it's just like, I mean, of all the things, these wondrous age that we live in of abundance and technology, I mean, the fundamental desire for a home and stability and security is totally. Just trumps everything.
And I think that's as it should.
I take the sort of more Austrian view of economics is more of a ground up organic kind of thing. And I don't think anyone's sort of looking at broad macro implications and what it means nationally. I think people are thinking, I want a bloody house. And the government's saying that if I vote for them or I approve this policy, I'm going to be able to do that. Whether that's right or wrong. And again, it's not to be unfair to people because this is what they're being told from their leaders, you know, and it just feels like, well, if I had that, then I could. I'm looking at the house that I want to buy. I can't afford it now. We're super. I could afford it. It will happen. It will happen. And
I'm
I know
not
that's
prepared
cynical,
to accept
but
that.
I'm sure it does. I'm sure
I,
it does.
I'm the patron saint of lost causes, mate. Maybe it does happen. I will. I don't
too
expect
seductive.
Anyone. No one is scared of me, and no one is scared of what I think or what I care about. I will bang this drum every single day until election day from here. Well, not every single day, continually until election day on this one. And whether it makes a difference or not, I don't know. Maybe you're right, mate. Maybe the glass is absolutely half full, maybe half empty, sorry. Maybe I should be paying more attention to that, but I'm not prepared to give that one up just yet. What I would ask our listeners to do is be informed on this stuff, have a view, talk to your family and friends. I'm not telling you how to vote. I'm not saying vote against this particular policy specifically. If you are inclined to support the LNP, then go and talk to them about what a stupid policy this is. If you are inclined to vote for Labor, then vote against it if that's what you want to do. I don't care how you vote. I mean, my point is there are other issues as well, and I'm not suggesting this one policy should be the vote decider. What I am saying is it is an absolute disgrace and it should be overturned forthwith. I hope the LNP are smart enough to stop it because that makes the whole life easier. If not, I am going to continue to bang this drum for many, many months to come, mate, because it is an absolute disgrace.
Yeah, I'm on your side. I mean, I'm just more cynical.
You are more cynical. That's okay. Yeah. Mate, we haven't got much time left over, but I did notice this week, let's go with some good news, shall we? Look, I'm a Treasury Wise Estate shareholder, so it's good news for me personally. That's okay. But I kind of, there's something in a podcast and a week and a year of, you know, good news being hard to come by. China has apparently issued a draft determination. Now, it could change before the final one is issued, but a draft determination to take tariffs off Australian wines. This is the last major commodity to have those tariffs removed after China and Australia got into a spat, was it 4 years ago now, something like that, maybe three?
It was a ScoMo special, wasn't it?
The previous Prime Minister deciding megaphone diplomacy might work. Surprisingly enough, doesn't work with the Chinese.
Who the thunk?
Exactly.
He's not the master tactician we all had him pegged for. Yeah, there you go. Go on.
Have you seen Nemesis? it is, anyway, not much to say other than very, very good news for winemakers, obviously good news for wine company shareholders, including me. But we haven't had much good news. And the Australian export of wine to China in particular has been an export bright spot for quite a while. The last lot of data we had, I think I probably shared in this podcast, sales are up 40% year on year. And I think it was literally the year before the tariffs were imposed, which just goes to show what our own goal this was. 20% of that was volume, 20% was price, which is also impressive. The Chinese economy, while it's, again, we've talked a lot about averages and totals and also individuals, the fact that the average Australian bottle of wine was up 20% price only shows the Chinese demand for, taste for wine, and the fact that those in China with money were spending it and spending up big on Australian wine. So hopefully for everyone's sake, one of the great things, we talk about GDP, you know what saved us GDP-wise was exports.
Mm.
The balance of trade, I believe I'm told.
It always saves us.
Well, it was larger than, it was the contribution to GDP of net exports was larger than the actual GDP growth itself. In other words, had that not been the case, GDP would have been negative. Yeah. And for an economy that we're relatively small in the world stage, that's kind of great on one level because it means the rest of the world's so big, we have plenty of export opportunities. And we are, as you say, mate, often normally a net exporter. But what it means is the economy can grow and be, you know, at whatever rate. We are making more stuff than we need to consume, which means our income is growing faster than our consumption, which is just exactly what you would want if you were designing an economy, particularly a small one like Australia's. So I'm hopeful that does augur well for broader exports, for broader, frankly, geopolitics from a personal perspective, but certainly from a trade perspective. I'm hopeful that it means, you know, more cohesive trade with China and the rest of the world. Maybe a lot of companies have realized that they shouldn't pin all their hopes on China. I think that's probably fair as well. But it should be good news economically, mate, if we can kind of partly weather the storm that's coming by growing our exports overseas. It'd be a lovely little bit of, you know, extra cream on top that we otherwise would have to make for ourselves that we get just by being able to sell our stuff overseas to countries like China who want stuff from brand Australia.
Yeah, I mean, trade is almost always mutually beneficial, you know.
Isn't it?
The Chinese are better because they get to have great Australian wine. We're better because we've got a new export market.
Exactly.
Like, win-win. You put yourself in those shoes.
Don't tell me you can find a negative out of here. Don't.
No.
Even, come on.
No, okay. Not at all. But it is, China is a trade partner that is complicated,
yes.
I guess I would say.
Describe it. Describe it.
It is a vast market. It's hard to, there are cities in China that have more people than Australia has.
Exactly.
Like your brain can't, my brain, yep. No, yep. You can't get your head around the size of that market, right?
Correct.
It is so ginormous. And if you're someone who's got something to export there, you're going to do it, right?
Yep.
And
yep.
And we did, made a fortune. Yep. But then it got taken away. And at the time, you'll remember this, it was like, we're going to diversify our export markets. And it always made me cringe, right? Because it's like, oh, you're telling me that there were all these other countries that were just as much in demand.
But yeah, that's right.
We're only going to sell to China.
We didn't buy. You know? Yeah, correct.
China's our BFF. We don't want to sell to Europe. Nah, you know, apparently, you know, North America wants. Nah, not interested. Of course, I mean, and it sort of feels like we often are critical of businesses when things sort of go wrong. It's like, well, why didn't you plan for, in the good times, plan for the bad times kind of thing. And I feel as though, I'm not trying to put a storm cloud over it. It's great news, but the reality is, and I think what the way that the market has reacted shows that you can't just diversify away from that massive market. You just can't replace that overnight. And it's just something I think it's got to be in the back of your head because, you know, things are getting frostier, if anything, between the West and China. And when we as investors, I'm not trying to tell people what to think or what's coming because I don't know, but as an investor, our job is to kind of think, well, what's the downside? What's the risk? What could go wrong? And that'd be one of the things in my bingo card for any company that's got a big market in China, A2 milk and those kinds of things. It's just like, it's great. Sell it. So, I mean, I would do the same. Go crazy. If there's a willing buyer and they're going to pay top dollar, you absolutely, it's your duty to do that. But prepare. I hope you've got. I hope there's a safe in the head office somewhere that someone cracks open and breaks open the instructions for when things like that go wrong. Because you've got to plan for even if it's an edge case possibility. And I don't know. So I guess I am being negative, but I would just sort of say, but you know, great, but let's hope we don't see someone else put their foot in their mouth and then they just shut off everything again. So
I think that's right. I think that's one of the if there has been a. I want to be careful here. Progress is important, and I'm half you. I think you're probably the same, but I'm a conservative investor, and I would run my listed company more conservatively than most are run. Mm-hmm. And that may actually not be the best thing for the economy overall, because maybe, you know, 100 companies running at capacity, when two fail, the other 98% doing great, and 100 running sub capacity, and none fail. You actually may have worse outcomes overall economically or even at a stock market level. So it's worth being a little bit careful and a portfolio level, frankly. If you've got 10 of them, you know, what do you want them each to do? Blackmores, I used to own Blackmores, I used to work there years ago, had massive sales growth in China. Yeah. And they made exactly that problem, was they, rather than looking at this and saying, this is great, but just, you know, the old Roman general, just remember you're mortal. This could go away at some point.
Yeah, they don't bet it like just like, oh, I've had a win. Oh, all in, right? Exactly. Like, whoa.
And it wasn't even so much all in terms of sales. It was all in terms of costs.
Yeah.
Companies always, always, always grow their cost to fill the available space, right? We get all this money. Oh, let's use some of it for X, Y, Z, which again is not unreasonable if the market is sustainable and consistent. But as you say about China, you know, if your entire business is China, you better have some cash in the bank. Yep. If your business is not all about China, but it's big in China, you'd want to have a cost base that just allows for the fact that you treat these as less than certain markets. Mm-hmm. And if it goes away, I don't expect people to have the same profitability afterwards. Of course you won't. And they should chase it. Blackmores was absolutely right to go hell for leather. Remember the Daigou trade, the suitcase trade of people? You know, they should have made those sales. They're mad not to. Mm-hmm. They made a lot of money doing it. The mistake was the conceit of, this will be forever, and so therefore we should build a business accordingly. Yes. That is the fundamental problem. And as I said, you're about to say, if you want cash in that safe as well as the instructions, and you want a business that says, let's make sure we don't over capitalize here. Let's not over hire. Let's not spend money we don't have. Let's use it forever in 15 years time, okay, this is stable, this is safe. Chinese consumers love it. We like the Chinese government. They like us. Good, we're good. Okay, we've done well.
Yeah.
But to pretend, believe, fool yourself into thinking this is forever and permanent. That's exactly where all of those companies came a cropper. And again, was Treasury wrong to sell wine to Asia? Of course not. Was Blackmores wrong to sell vitamins? Of course not. But at some point, you got to say, actually, you know, if and when this goes away, and as investors, by the way, this is the investment angle, invest accordingly. Think about the price you pay on exactly that basis. What if this goes away? Will I have overpaid? The investors who bought $150 Blackmore shares or $80 Treasury shares or, you know, again, I don't know,
that was the other problem. Everyone extrapolated. So you had that market open up out of didn't exist, then it existed, and over a period of years, but you know, relatively short space of time, it just opened up.
Yep.
And then we see these exponential sort of J curves, and we just the market extrapolates, and it's like, no, it asymptotes at a point. Like there is a natural ceiling within all of that. So it's even when you take away the risk of overinvestment. Maybe they're making appropriate investments for what they need to supply to that market.
Yeah.
But investors in the share market are going, oh, wow, they're going to grow revenue at 30% for, you know, the next 20 years. Like, well, are they? I don't know. So lots of lessons from all of that.
Crazy. Speaking of lessons, mate, we might come back on Sunday with some lessons from, I promised this last week, and our poor listener who thought he was going to have his question answered, we didn't quite get to, I felt very guilty, and I got a tweet during the week, a direct message saying, hey, you made me wait and you didn't do it. Our first cab off the rank, because I just obviously have, I don't know, I've run over a cat or something, black cats crossed my path, broken about 85,000 mirrors. We're going to talk about Bitcoin on Sunday is our first question. And then hopefully we can talk about something actually that makes more sense.
We'll keep it short. Yeah.
That's officially a lie, but we will do our best. Until then, enjoy your Friday afternoon and your Saturday, or maybe your Tuesday morning if that's what you're listening. But until Sunday, fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.